Hello, everybody. I'm Howie Hawkins. I was the Green Party candidate and the Socialist Party candidate for president in 2020. And this podcast, Green Socialist Notes, is about continuing to educate and advocate for the eco-socialist program that my running mate, Angela Walker, and I ran on in 2020. So the top issue, again, still, is Gaza. We're watching genocide and living color on our TV screens. And now the U.S. is holding back funds for UNRWA, which is the UN Relief and Works Agency, which provides aid to Palestinian refugees. The U.S. provides 20 to 25% of its $1.5 billion annual budget. And we pulled the funding because there are allegations that a dozen out of 13,000 employees were involved in that October 7th Hamas attack on Israel. So if that's true, and it's, you know, we haven't seen the evidence for the deeds of a few, the whole Palestinian people are being punished, collective punishment, because this agency not only serves with food and schools and healthcare and other services people in Gaza, but also on the West Bank and Palestinian refugee camps in Lebanon, Syria, and Jordan. So U.S. complicity in genocide is deepening, despite some equivocating words from Biden and Blinken. And now Israel is saying they're going to wage war on the giant refugee camp of 1.7 million people it has created in Rafah, in Gaza's far south on the Egyptian border. That refugee camp is 1.4 million people who fled from the north, who have joined 280,000 Gazans who already lived in Rafah. Yesterday, airstrikes hit Rafah, killing 22 people. And Israel's preparing this ground invasion. It says it will conduct a mass evacuation of those people now in Rafah, but where are they going to send them to? They haven't said. Will Israel finally expel them to Egypt in a massive act of ethnic cleansing? That's what the fascist far-right members of the Israeli cabinet have been advocating. And even though the U.S. is speaking out against this ground incursion into Rafah, it isn't using the leverage it has, which is the military aid to Israel, which it could cut off or threaten to cut off if Israel goes ahead with this genocidal attack on this 1.7 million person refugee camp. So this genocidal war continues unabated, and we need to keep speaking up for a permanent ceasefire in Gaza, emergency humanitarian aid to the people in Gaza who are suffering from lack of food, water, and medicine, not to mention housing, restoration of funding to UNRWA. That should be one of our demands. We should call for an end to military aid to Israel until it stops its policies of apartheid and occupation, and demand a real peace process toward a political solution. I'm afraid this talk of a two-state solution from people like the Saudis and the U.S. is just a cover for normalizing relations between the Sunni Arab autocracies like Saudi Arabia and the U.S. to get the heat off it. We've been through negotiating processes several times since the Resolution 242 that called for a two-state, in the U.N. General Assembly calling for a two-state solution back in 1967. And the U.S. has never played a role, so a sincere role. So that's something we really have to push for. And while all this is going on, the Emergency National Security Bill finally came up for a vote in the Senate this week. The original bill, which included $20 billion for border control, was $118.3 billion, including about $60 billion for Ukraine, $14 billion in security assistance for Israel without any restrictions on human rights conditions, which is already the law under the Leahy Amendment, and includes a ban on aid to UNRWA, which even Israeli leaders are saying, we can't service Gaza and these other communities like on the West Bank without UNRWA. So, I mean, the U.S. is just way off the mark on this issue. There's $10 billion for humanitarian aid for civilians in global crises, including Palestinians, Ukrainians, Afghans, Sudanese, and about 10 other nations in crisis around the world. The $20 billion for border control was terrible. And it's a good thing that this bill did not pass the Senate in this form. It provides for summary deportation without due process. So the ACLU is, you know, very much up in arms about that. It would mean more families separated, more children detained, more people sent back to where they came from to face persecution, torture, and death. There are caps on immigration, so the border would close if 5,000 or more people per day showed up over a 7-day period. And Biden has said he would close the border like he's Donald Trump. He's pandering to the Republican scaremongering. Asylum is made far more difficult. They remove hearings from the courts where there's due process to some kind of internal review board, I guess run by ICE or Border Patrol. It does maintain preferences for some peoples, Cubans, Nicaraguans, Venezuelans, Haitians, Ukrainians, and Afghans. But it limits the number of green cards per year to 50,000 a year for 5 years. And it provides no pathway to citizenship for the Dreamers or longtime undocumented residents. So this is, you know, a Trump-type immigration policy, which, you know, Biden and the Democrats, most of them were ready to go along with. That failed midweek, I think it was Wednesday, with several Democrats voting against it, four of them in the Senate. So it failed 49 to 50. But these people were silent on the other problems with the bill, including the humanitarian crises at the border and in Ukraine, Palestine, Afghanistan, Sudan, and the rest of these countries. So what Schumer did on Thursday was strip the bill of the border reform and reintroduce the package on Wednesday, slightly changed. It was $95.3 billion total, $60 billion to support Ukraine for its self-defense against Russia, an additional $481 million to aid displaced Ukrainians. It still provided $14.1 billion in military aid to Israel. There's $9.5 billion in humanitarian assistance for Gaza and the West Bank, Ukraine, and these other conflict zones, which is good. The amount going to Taiwan and other countries in the Indo-Pacific is upped to almost $5 billion, $4.83 billion. There's another $2.44 billion to support the U.S. Central Command operations, which means the strikes on the Houthis and, you know, strike backs at the Iranian-supported militias in Syria and Iraq. And then $400 million to help nonprofits in places of worship beef up security, because there's a lot of Islamophobic and anti-Semitic attacks going on. So, you know, most of that bill is good, I think, except for the security assistance for Israel. It wasn't getting enough votes on Wednesday. The Republicans couldn't figure out what the hell they were doing. So Schumer left the vote open until Thursday, and it passed 67 to 32. Now, that was what passed was they will open up debate on the bill. They call it cloture. And 17 Republicans and all the Democrats voted yes, except Bernie Sanders, because he was upset that it included the Israeli military aid and the ban on funding to UNRWA, which is a good reason to vote no. So the debate has begun, and Schumer has said the vote on the substance of the bill will take place before the senators leave for a scheduled 2-week vacation that was supposed to start on Friday. And Rand Paul, not surprisingly, is threatening to do a one-person veto to slow down the process. So the final vote will still have to pass the filibuster threshold of 60 votes. It does have a chance of passing. Whether it will pass is up in the air, because the far-right Republicans don't want to aid Ukraine like Trump tells them not to, or to. And reporters in the Capitol expect it will pass by early next week. the senators do want to go on vacation, so they will get to a vote. But if it passes the Senate, it's going to have a tougher time in the House. Trump's influence on the far-right Republicans is stronger there. Speaker Mike Johnson is taking his orders from Trump. So it may take a discharge petition to force a floor vote, which would mean that it would require the conservative Republicans who are not far-right crazies to join with the Democrats to get that discharge petition to get a vote. And so it's iffy. And meanwhile, Ukraine is running out of air defense missiles and artillery shells. New York Times reported yesterday that Ukraine will run out of defense missiles, air defense missiles, by March. And if they do, there will be nothing to stop Russia from carpet bombing Ukrainian cities like it did Mariupol in Ukraine, or it has done in the past with Grozny in Chechnya or Aleppo in Syria. And after a year, little movement on the front lines, not only could Russia begin carpet bombing Ukrainian cities that are now protected by air defense systems, it could begin advancing on the front lines against Ukrainian forces that are running out of artillery shells to repel them. And while the front lines hardly moved in 2023, Ukraine has made advances by attacking assets, Russian military assets, supply lines, behind the front lines. And, you know, the narrative is Russia, Ukraine is losing the war, but Russia's Black Sea has been defeated by Ukrainian drone boats. They can't operate in the Black Sea. They can't block the grain exports, which have resumed because the Russians' Black Sea fleet can't get close to those coasts without being attacked by these drone boats and also cruise missiles. The Patriot air defense missiles have shot down a number of Russia's Su-34 fighter jets, preventing them from making sorties against the front lines. They can't get close enough to release their glide bombs. And the Su-34 is no joke. It's a much more sophisticated fighter jet than the F-16s, which the U.S. has promised and Western Europe has promised, but still has not delivered to Ukraine. Even with limited artillery, Ukrainian FPV drones, that's first person view, because somebody sits there like in a video game and directs the drone right into the tank or armored vehicle that they're attacking. It's been effective in holding back Russians' offensives. And in fact, Russia's loss of armored vehicles, depending on the week, is 3-1, 4-1, sometimes 10-1 in some of these frontline battles. And Russia's losing far more troops. And then also Ukrainian drone strikes against Russia's oil refineries are having a big impact. They've been attacked from the Baltic Sea in the north to the Black Sea in the south. And it forced Russia's energy ministry last week to announce they're cutting oil exports by 37% due to limited refining capacity. And that's a lot of income that the Russian war machine depends on. So, you know, Ukraine is doing all right. They aren't pushing Russia out, but they aren't getting pushed back, and Russia's not taking more land at this point. And then look at the bigger picture. You know, Russia initially thought they could take the capital, Kyiv, in a few days and install a puppet government. They were defeated in that. And over the course of 2022, Ukraine took back half the land that the Russian military initially occupied. 2023, yes, the front lines were stable, but Ukraine has inflicted severe costs on the Russian army in terms of its offenses on the front line and also behind the front lines, like I just described. But in 2024, Russia could occupy more Ukrainian territories if the U.S. doesn't send ammunition and Ukraine is relatively disarmed. You know, what I wonder is, where is the progressive who wants to support Ukraine but not Israeli genocide and wants this other humanitarian aid to go? Why haven't they called on Schumer to separate the Ukrainian aid from the Israeli aid and the other aid? Instead, you got to vote for it as a package. So Sanders is saying, I can't stand the Israeli aid, so I'm going to vote against it, even though I might support aid to Ukraine. And other senators are saying, well, I'm going to vote for it because of the Ukraine aid, even if I'm not happy with the Israeli aid. Those things should be separated. And if you're talking to your representatives in Congress, you might ask them why the hell they don't push for that. So meanwhile, the other thing that happened this week that really caught my attention was in Brazil, Bolsonaro, like his role model Trump, who plotted a coup like Trump did against, in this case, Lula's win in the presidential election last October. This week, the Supreme Court of Brazil seized Bolsonaro's passport, pending what looks like are going to be indictments and arrests for this coup attempt. I mean, Bolsonaro was alleging there would be election fraud even before the election was held, like Trump did. He was mobilizing his supporters, and they did attempt to seize Capitol buildings, like Trump did. And what Bolsonaro did was he was working with military leaders to seize power under martial law if they lost the election. And I'm not sure to the extent that went in Brazil, but, you know, Trump was talking about that. Remember, Michael Flynn was pushing that in meetings, but the U.S. military wasn't with Trump on a coup. So that didn't happen. But the thing is, look, in Brazil, it only took them 9 months after the election for the Brazilian federal court to rule that Bolsonaro was ineligible to run for election until at least 2030 because of his role in that attempted coup after the election last October. And then this week, it's only 16 months later, this Brazilian Supreme Court seized the passports and looks like they're getting ready to indict and arrest Bolsonaro and his top co-conspirators. So the wheels of justice are turning a lot faster in Brazil than the USA. The same day that Bolsonaro had his passport seized, the U.S. Supreme Court heard arguments about the Colorado Supreme Court decision to keep Trump off the ballot. From the hearings, it looks like they're going to keep him on the ballot. They're going to rule he should be on the ballot by at least 8-1. I mean, even liberals Kagan and Jackson were saying the 14th Amendment gives the state the right to exclude insurrectionists for state elections and election to Congress, but not to the presidency because it's a national election. That seems to me be stretching the law, but we'll see. Trump's probably going to win that one. But the question for us is, why the hell did it take the Biden administration so long to indict Trump for insurrection? Merrick Garland, the attorney general, I think was afraid that the MAGA Republicans would accuse him of a politicized prosecution. For the first year after the election in 2020, Garland only had four prosecutors dealing with all of the people that invaded the Capitol. The fact is, you know, Garland saying he wants to avoid looking like it's politicized, his decision not to really get prosecutors on this case was itself political. And so it took almost 2 years until November 2022, a little more than a year ago, for Garland to appoint Jack Smith as a special prosecutor for the two federal cases Trump faces, the coup attempt and the classified documents case. And within 7 months, Smith had indicted Trump on the classified documents case. That was in June last year. And by August, 9 months later, Smith had indicted Trump on the attempted coup. The coup case was scheduled by the judge for March, but it's now delayed because Trump has claimed he has immunity, which, as I pointed out, you know, the hearing on that in the Supreme Court. Oh, what happened this week was the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals issued a scathing ruling saying Trump is out of his mind to think he has immunity from all criminal liability while he's president. Trump, of course, is appealing to the Supreme Court, which they could decide quickly or they could wait months and draw it out until it's too late to have a trial before the election. Now, if Trump wins the elections, he'll order the charges against him dropped. So, you know, Biden ran on 2020 on stopping Trump, and he hasn't done it while he had the presidential power. And now he may end up handing power back to Trump in the next election. And this insurrection case is key to the presidential elections in 2024. If Trump were to be convicted on that case, it would make it much harder for him to get votes, particularly from independents who lean Republican. And let's remember, you know, that case would be a lot more severe than the cases he's already lost. Remember, he lost the Trump University fraud case in 27 while he was the president, and he had to pay $25 million in damages. He lost the Trump Foundation case in 2019, which forced him to shut down the foundation and pay $2 million to various charities. He recently lost two sexual harassment and defamation cases regarding E. Jean Carroll and has to pay now $83 million in damages. He's lost the bank fraud case. What's pending is how much damages he's going to pay. And, you know, most people think it's going to be hundreds of millions of dollars. And that judgment may also force the closure of his business, the Trump Organization in New York, where he has a lot of properties and does a lot of business. So that judgment may well bankrupt Trump. But those are the civil cases, and he's got four criminal case indictments. In New York, there's the Stormy Daniels hush money case, which is a campaign violation case. And that case is ready to go before the election. And if the other cases don't, that will go forward, and it's state. He can't pardon himself for state crimes. In Georgia, there's the election racketeering case where Trump, you know, we've heard the phone call. He tried to get the Secretary of State to find him enough votes so he could win Florida. But the problem there is the prosecutor, Fannie Willis, has had, you know, romantic relations with her lead prosecutor, and there's been a lot of money paid to that prosecutor. So that situation is being looked into, and that could delay the case till after the election. And then there are the two big federal cases, the classified documents, which the Trump lawyers are delaying with motions over the discovery process. And there's a good chance that will be held off until after the election. And of course, the biggest one is the coup case, the election obstruction case. And we had the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals decision this week saying he's not immune, but it's going to the Supreme Court. So we're waiting on that one. And of course, if Trump can delay these cases till after the election and he is elected, he can just make the Justice Department drop the cases. Besides, the Justice Department has a policy going back. It's a memo they wrote going back to Watergate and dealing with Nixon that a sitting president could not be prosecuted by the federal government. Although that memo has never been tested in court. And it's really debatable whether the state justice systems could prosecute a sitting president for criminal charges. You know, the Trump University and Trump Foundation cases were civil. So that's another question up in the air. And of course, impeachment always remains a recourse, but in the end, it takes a two-thirds majority in the Senate to convict, which is not likely to happen, as we saw in the first two Trump impeachments when he was president. So, you know, I'm just saying all this because I think it's really sad that Biden and Garland didn't move faster on the attempted coup, like Brazil has, and shown us a better way. The lead coupster, Donald Trump may yet get away with it. And Biden ran on election, you know, saying he would stop Trump and the MAGA Republicans, and he hasn't. In fact, he's still trying to do bipartisanship with the party that tried to overthrow his election. Just look at this border plus foreign aid compromise he, you know, had his people try to negotiate. And so, you know, the fact is the Democrats don't know how to fight the right. We need to defeat the right, not normalize them by trying to cut deals with them and compromise with them. We need to defeat them. And that's why we can't rely on the Democrats, and we need the Green Party. So that's my rant for today. See what you got to say. Violet at Content Boutique. Howie, any comments on the Putin interview? Well, I haven't watched the whole 2 hours. I've watched some snitches and read a lot of commentary. And, you know, Tucker Carlson is just a cupcake. I mean, he let Putin dominate the interview. Putin went through half an hour of a long, boring false history lesson. And, you know, even Carlson, you know, kind of wondered what the relevance was, you know, to the current situation in Ukraine. And you know, Putin kind of arrogantly just shut him up. I remember one comment where Putin said, well, if the U.S. stops providing arms to Ukraine, we can wrap up the war in a few weeks, something like that. I doubt that will happen. If Ukraine's disarmed, Russia's going to at least go for all the oblasts that will give them control of the Black Sea and a land bridge to its to Moldova, where they have you know, an occupying force in Transnistria on the eastern side of Moldova. And they may go for Kyiv. I mean, if they think they can get it and install a puppet government. I mean, that was the objective. Putin has been saying repeatedly that his goals remain the same. Denazification, which means regime change, replacing the current government with a government that is under Russia's control, and demilitarization, which means Russia controls the military space of Ukraine. And, you know, he hasn't backed down from that. In fact, he's getting more aggressive in saying that. He said it in his annual press conference in December and said it in recent remarks. So, see what else I remember hearing. There's a long history lesson, and the thing I paid attention to was, you know, what he said about Ukraine. And, you know, Tucker Carlson, basically his questions sort of premised, or in the questions were the premises of the Russian narrative about Ukraine. So it was certainly not an aggressive interview. It was basically a platform for Putin that Carlson provided. So, you know, I don't think it's really going to change much. I thought Putin didn't read the room. I mean, his audience there was people in the West, because it was translated in English and, you know, broadcast on X, formerly Twitter. His audience in the West is the far right. That's who he's been aligned with. At one point, you know, he said, why is the U.S. involved in Ukraine when it's got its own problems back home, like immigration and the debt, which are the Republican, you know, talking points? He was appealing to the far right. But I think he lost him in that first half hour. You know, he went on and on and on about, you know, history going back to the 9th century. And I don't know how many people are going to sit through that. So I think he probably lost his audience there. So those are a few thoughts. I'm looking for a transcript so I can, you know, clip out some of his comments to comment on, you know, like what he said about if the U.S. stops arming Ukraine, the war will end. Yeah, the war will end when Russia gets what it wants. I think that's what he really means. So, you know, and Carlson said he was the first Western reporter to want to interview Putin, which is so false. Even Peskov, the Russian, you know, spokesperson, said, well, that's not true. We just didn't like any of the Westerners that wanted to interview Putin. And a number of reporters, you know, Anan Amanpour and the BBC reporter and others said, yeah, we've been trying to get an interview to ask a question to Putin. I saw on BBC, the BBC reporter in Russia, you know, he was at that press conference Putin held at the end of the year with his BBC sign. And, you know, he pointed out, you know, Putin didn't call on him. So, you know, that was kind of self-aggrandizing by Carlson. And it was so bad, even the Russians had to check him on it. So those are my comments on the Putin interview. Scout Trooper 164, I should mention as well that the new commander-in-chief for Ukraine was responsible for the defense of Kyiv and Kherson and the Kherson offensive and managing a den in Wagner. Let's not dismiss him yet. Yeah, I don't think we should. One positive thing about it is it showed that the civilian leadership, the military is subordinate to the civilian leadership, which is what you want in a democratic society. Whether, you know, Zelensky was not a good commander, as Zelensky concluded, I question, because I think what Zelensky did was, he wrote that article, I guess it was published in The Economist, where he said, you know, the front lines are frozen, stalemated, and we need, you know, better weapons, better technology. And also, and this is where I think his big problem with Zelensky was, we need to mobilize 500,000 Ukrainians into the armed forces to defeat the Russians by pushing them out of Ukraine. And Zelensky, you know, that's not going to be popular with people that don't want to fight in a war and, you know, get drafted. So Zelensky pushed back. But I think that's a real issue. There was an article this week, I think it was the Washington Post, it may have been the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, where a lot of the units on the front lines are understaffed because there are not enough new people coming in, or people with combat experience who know what the hell they're doing and won't get killed right away. And so they're you know, in a difficult situation. They are sitting there not getting rotated, getting tired, which inevitably affects your morale and your competence in terms of, you know, operating. So, you know, there are real problems there. And I think Zelensky brought them to attention. The fact that he did publicly, I think Zelensky didn't like. But, you know, if you saw the Zelensky gave Zelensky and another guy that heads their military intelligence, you know, the top honor, military honor. And, you know, Zelensky was smiling. He hugged Zelensky when he got it, whereas the other guy just gave him, you know, a handshake and a salute. So it doesn't look like it's personal. At least they're putting on a good face. So we'll have to see what happens. But the guy that replaced him, Sersky, I think his name is, the reporting is, you know, the rank and file of troops, they love Zelensky. This guy has mixed reviews because he's very aggressive and will put people in dangerous situations, whereas Zelensky was focused on preserving, you know, the military personnel and, you know, only taking those risks that had a good chance of succeeding. So, you know, this will have an impact down the chain of command to the rank and file, and we'll have to see. I'm not judging or second guessing Zelensky, but I do have questions, and we need to watch what happens. So this guy Sersky did lead the defense of Kyiv. He did take the offensive, and actually Zelensky wasn't so enthusiastic about it, but that Kherson, well, the Kharkiv offensive is where Zelensky wasn't sure it was strategic, but that was very successful. They took almost all of Kharkiv Oblast back in September very quickly when the Russians, you know, weren't ready for them. And that was a big advance. And then Kherson later in the year, I don't know who gets credit for that. I mean, what the Ukrainians did was bomb all the bridges by which Russia was resupplying its troops across the Dnipro River. And it couldn't be resupplied, so they had to retreat. And, you know, that recovered the biggest city the Russians had occupied, Kherson, on the west bank of the, what they call the right bank of the Dnipro River, and Russia still on the left side. So it's something to watch. I think, you know, what we can do from here is, you know, provide moral, diplomatic, and military support to the Ukrainian resistance. And I'm confident whoever the commander in chief is, the Ukrainians are going to fight well, because they've shown that it's their country. They're fighting for their very existence, for their families, and, they'll keep fighting. So, I think that's where it's at. Vicky Condon. Comments about Bill 549 in Iowa, basically legalizing transphobia, and a similar bill in West Virginia. Well, I'm not familiar with the details of that bill, but a lot of these bills are criminalizing medical treatment for transgender people transitioning or not. You know, I mean, there's psychological and medical considerations, and just giving them medical treatment for that is being criminalized in a lot of these states. And it's another case of the Republicans picking on a minority and making people scared of this minority, as if, you know, people are out there saying, I think I'll become a transgender person. You know, your sexual orientation is pretty much wired into you. It's not something you pick from a menu. And to, you know, focus on attacking transgender people is just bigotry, and it's mean-spirited, and it's designed to divide and conquer. That's the right-wing mode of operation. So I can't comment on that bill in particular, but I can say generally this whole attack on trans people by the right is disgusting. And we need to fight back and speak up. I mean, some people don't want to speak up because they, you know, it's a minority that doesn't have much power and they just want to stay out of the fire. But, you know, what that German pastor said about, you know, Nazi Germany, you know, first they came for the communists and I said nothing because I wasn't a communist. And then they came for these people and I said nothing because I wasn't these people. And, you know, finally they came for the Jews and I wasn't a Jew. And then they finally came for me and there was nobody left to speak up. So that's why, you know, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. And we all need to defend people who are under attack for just being who they are. Scout Trooper 164. It feels weird that the aid border bill was essentially everything the Republicans wanted. But because Biden is a Democrat and that would give him a victory, not for Trump, the Republicans voted no. Yeah, it feels weird and it's morally disgusting. I mean, these people are, these right-wing Republicans are sacrificing people at the border in Ukraine, in Gaza, just because they want to get a, you know, a talking point against Biden for the election. You know, that is, you know, treating people as, you know, it's just disrespecting all kinds of people. It has no moral basis. And so, you know, you found out what the only thing the Republicans really want is to send more arms to Israel, because Speaker Mike Johnson tried to get a separate bill on that passed after the bill that included all its elements was defeated in the Senate. Or maybe he did that before then. And you know, that shows what they really want. They don't care about the Ukrainians. They don't care about people at the border. You know, they're kind of on board with Israeli genocide of Palestinians. But what they're really on board for is, you know, a talking point for the election, saying Biden can't get things done when they're the ones that stopped this bill from going forward. It is, yeah, it's more than weird. It's morally repulsive. Emil Sachs, laugh out loud. Does them quote unquote leadership really want Trump to go away though? He is great for them to hold over our heads anytime we demand they actually govern from the left. They are already salivating at the thought of throwing Stein off the ballot, though. Yeah, two issues there. One is, yeah, like Hillary Clinton in 2016, they really want to run against Trump because he's such a terrible candidate, got so much baggage. They think they can beat him, even with Joe Biden. And then, yeah, there's lots of reporting. There have been a number of articles about Democratic associated super PACs and high powered law firms getting ready to knock Stein as well as Cornel West and Robert Kennedy off the ballot. And, you know, that just shows what hypocrites the Democrats are, because one of the issues, even though, well, Biden, he announced his reelection campaign saying he was going to fight for democracy. But he doesn't really have much of a program. He failed to get the Voting Rights Act restored, which was part of H.R. 1, the top priority of that first session of Congress when he was president in 2021-22, because he wouldn't take on a filibuster because he wanted to do bipartisanship with the far-right Republicans. So he's not defending our democratic rights. And meanwhile, the Democrats turn around and attack our democratic right to offer our candidate on the ballot. So the Democrats aren't very damn democratic. And that's why we need the Green Party. We need to lead the fight for democratic rights, from restoring the Voting Rights Act to getting ranked choice voting and proportional representation so we can have an inclusive multi-party democracy instead of this exclusive two corporate party system. So we're going to have a fight on our hands, and we know who the players are. You know, one of them is Mark Elias, who is, you know, got a lot of credit for beating Trump something like 60 times on his, you know, election lie court cases. And, you know, Elias beat him every time. Well, good. But what has he done, you know, for more than 20 years? He was the counsel for John Kerry when he ran for president in 2004 that harassed the Nader campaign with dozens of lawsuits, most of them frivolous, having no basis, to drain resources and time and energy away from the Nader campaign. It was the most consorted, or, you know, it was the biggest attack on voter ballot access in American history. You know, Richard Winger of Ballot Access News has studied this, and, you know, he's written articles in law reviews about how this was off the charts, what they did to Nader. And that was Mark Elias. And when I ran in 2020, and where we were attacked in Montana and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania, it was lawyers affiliated with him, lawyers that he got mobilized in these states, that attacked our ballot access. So the Democrats are no friend to democracy, and anybody who thinks we can rely on them to protect and expand our democratic rights is whistling in the dark, because you just got to look at their record. You know, they failed on the Voting Rights Act when they had both houses of Congress and Biden was president. And the other, you know, election protection measures that were part of H.R. 1. And now they're attacking our ballot access, which is, you know, what they've been doing ever since the Greens showed up. Because, you know, what they're really afraid of is that we'll get a lot of votes because our platform is more popular than theirs on questions like healthcare, Medicare for all, climate action, the Green New Deal, tax fairness, tax the rich, and so forth. So they just rather do like what Putin just did to his anti-war opponent this week. You know, this guy submitted 200,000 signatures. He needed 100,000 nationwide to be on the ballot, and they happened to find that he was short by 5,000 signatures. Big surprise. And this guy really, I mean, he has friends in the Kremlin. He's not that much of an opposition figure, but his campaign was, we should get out of Ukraine, which would have got a lot of votes in Russia, particularly where people felt their ballot was secret. A lot of people vote electronically now in Russia so they can manipulate the vote results. And so that's not so secret, but there's still a lot of paper balloting. And, but he was knocked off the ballot. So, you know, the Russians do what we do. They probably learned it from us when they got their, you know, got past the Soviet Union and started what was supposed to be a democracy. And then the people that got the power around Putin figured, you know, we can rig these elections. And that's what they do. B.D. Dimmitt, normalizing right-wing extremism was part of the DNC strategy laid out in the Pied Piper memo, leaked to and published by Assange. I'm not familiar with the Pied Piper memo, but it wouldn't surprise me. And I'm wondering, though, you know, what that memo says in terms of why it's a good strategy to have an extreme, well, I guess we can imagine, we already talked about it, you know, an extreme right wing out there encourages a lot of people who are more progressive than the Democratic Party to vote for it, to stop the far right extremists. So but whatever that memo said, Biden has been doing it. You know, and we just had the most recent example in this whole negotiation around linking border, the border to the, you know, foreign aid for Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan, and humanitarian aid to many places. Kerry Chick Campbell, Green Party Jill Stein campaign, your observations. The February 29th free and equal debate will include Wes Stein and Jasmine Sherman for president. Stein and Sherman are Green Party candidates. Were you impressed by Stein, Wes, Sherman voted into the top six candidates for the debate and RFK Jr. not making the top six? Finally, Green Party congressional candidates coming on your show soon. Thanks, Howie. To answer the last one first, I was talking with Christina Khalil earlier today, and she's going to come on soon. She's got to pick a date. So my Saturdays right now are open in terms of guests. So it should happen soon with Christina Khalil. And it's interesting that I think that shows that there's a lot more Greens out there than, you know, people at the grassroots. Let's say Greens who are connected and motivated, you know, by Green parties at the state level, at the grassroots level, for, you know, all the Green, and I guess West is kind of in that milieu because he was with us for a minute, getting in, whereas RFK did not. I mean, he's a media phenomenon. He's a very rich guy, but, you know, his enthusiasm at the base may not be very much. So that's interesting. So that's three candidates. I know two were libertarians. I forget who the other candidate was. Maybe it was Marianne Williamson. I'm not sure, but she's already dropped out. So anyway, that's just a small indication that, you know, the Greens are no joke. We do have a base. So that's interesting that RFK Jr. did not get voted in to the free and equal. And it's especially significant because free and equal, you know, that group is basically libertarians. And RFK is, you know, schmoozing with the libertarians. He may even seek their nomination to get on the ballot. So, you know, the libertarians that voted in this thing, I guess they didn't like Kennedy so much. But that's, I think, an interesting observation. Ashley R., how do you reconcile your Putin interview questions with your Putin-sponsored candidate? Jill Stein is not sponsored by Putin. Let's just be clear about that. I have my criticisms of Jill. I think she's a little credulous about the intentions and motivations of Putin's Russia. I think she's wrong on calling for us to cut off arms to Ukraine. She's in the same camp with the far-right Republicans. But, you know, those are my reservations. Otherwise, her platform's progressive. And Joe Biden is not, and particularly, he's Genocide Joe, like the, you know, Arab, Muslim, and younger voters are saying. They're just totally disgusted at what he's doing, basically letting Netanyahu basically disrespect him in public. Because Biden is saying, oh, you can't kill so many civilians. You can't enter, you know, do a ground operation in Rafah. And Netanyahu is saying, yeah, I'm going to do it, and you can't stop me. Biden, you know, is looking weak, as well as, you know, just totally immoral to let that go along. So Jill is not Putin sponsored. You know, what happened at the RT event in 2015, she paid her own way. I was part of the discussions leading up to that. And one of the people in that call said, you know, it might not be a good idea because whatever you say, and what Jill wanted to say is both, you know, the U.S. and Russia should stop sending arms and their allies sending arms into Syria, and it needs a political solution, and we need to work on nuclear disarmament. It was a peace message. And I think, you know, they wanted her there for show, not to hear what she had to say. But in any case, at that dinner where she's, you know, she was seated, she didn't choose her seat. Putin showed up for about 5 minutes for the picture. And Sputnik immediately sent it out on the internet because that was their point. And so in the discussions, one guy said, you know, a picture could overwhelm everything else you do while you're there. And that's what happened. But, you know, I think Jill was a victim there of, you know, Russian state media, which I think, you know, maybe she should have realized, you know, she might be. She just put her in a place where she could be used. But, you know, that happened 9 years ago now. And she paid her own way. You know, they offered to pay. She said, no, I'm going to pay my own way to maintain my independence, which I think was the right way to do it. But that picture is just, you know, like one of those people in the email thread said, you know, you don't want that to happen. And that's what happened. So that's my view on that. Jill knows it. And I'm still, you know, helping her with messaging and platform stuff. You know, I've given her two little memos, you know, at the request of somebody in her campaign is doing that, coordinating that kind of stuff in the last 2 days. So hopefully that's having some influence. Email, your thoughts on a proposed New York State law that would revoke the business license of companies guilty of wage theft. Yeah, that law has been proposed since I was, you know, from when I was running for governor, at least in 2014, if not before. And I worked a lot on that, particularly with the Chinese Workers Association in New York, which is, you know, really focused on that because they have a lot of people that do home health aid. And the way New York regulates that is you're on duty 24 hours, but you only get paid 13. You know, the other time you're supposed to be sleeping and eating and doing whatever. But the fact is when you're taking care of people that, you know, could need emergency help at any point, you're on duty 24 hours. So, you know, there's wages being stolen right there. And a lot of times when workers will bring these companies to court and they will win the case, and then the company will dissolve. But what they really do is just change their business name, move the address, and reopen and do the same things over and over again. So there's another provision in these laws that have been proposed to stop wage theft that basically puts a lien on their property before they can do this paper maneuvering to get out from the court judgment. And this is a huge problem. It's billions of dollars a year. I forget the numbers in New York. I think it's something like $50 billion nationwide. And, you know, it happens a lot in agriculture, construction, home health aids. But it also happens in big companies. I had an experience working for UPS where the supervisors were modifying people's time cards. And, you know, the time cards are one thing, but the record they sent to the company, which affected their pay and also the supervisor's numbers in terms of productivity. They were stealing wages from us. And these damn supervisors would always, you know, when we got the trucks unloaded or the trucks loaded for other people that were loaders, you know, rush to the time card punch out so you're not stealing time from us. And here they were stealing time from us workers. So, you know, we documented that, caught them. And the happiest day of my career at UPS was the day I got paid, you know, triple pay for another violation they did of, you know, in this case, I was supposed to be paid double time because it was holiday work. And the supervisor put it in for a straight time. And they also shortchanged me on the time. And they admitted the shortchange on the time as a quote-unquote mistake. And then said, well, I put in for a double time, but you didn't get it. And, you know, so I did my part. So I brought a grievance up. I won the grievance. They didn't even have a hearing. It was so obvious. So the day I got my double back pay was the same day that the sheriff's deputies came in and marched these supervisors out of the building for wage theft, you know, and it was a great day at UPS. So, but anyway, it's a huge problem, and this law should pass. And we actually got it passed when Cuomo was governor, and he pocket vetoed it. He never signed it. And now we got Hochul, who was Cuomo's lieutenant governor, handpicked, and we'll probably get it passed. I think we can get it passed this year in the legislature, which is, you know, overwhelmingly Democratic with a lot of progressives. And I don't think the business community is going to be able to stop it. But Hochul, you know, it's a question of whether she'll sign it if it's passed. So we need to fight this. I mean, wage theft is such obvious exploitation. I mean, capitalism, even when it pays the wages it says it's supposed to pay you, a company says it's going to pay you, is still stealing your labor because you're not getting the full value of your labor. The company's taking part of that as profits that go to shareholders who didn't do a damn lick of work for the value you produced as a worker. So that's institutionalized wage theft, legalized wage theft. But the, you know, the wage theft, when they get greedy and go beyond that, is illegal. But it's hard to enforce it against these companies. So, you know, this law would be a positive step forward in that regard, in, you know, disincentivizing wage theft. And I hope it passes. Scout Trooper 164, I can't help but laugh at Mike Johnson. Only been a speaker a few months, and he's failed so many major events during his time. He even accidentally called Israel Iran. Yeah, maybe he's too old. He's a young-looking man, but he's doing the same kind of mistakes as Trump and Biden, getting countries mixed up. And but in his case, it may not be lack of memory. It just may be ignorance. You know, some of these people can't, you know, I'm talking about people in Congress. They can't find some of these countries on the map. They just don't know what they're doing. And they're there because they got promoted by, you know, the machines of the two parties, which are funded by business. And all they're interested in getting is, you know, pro-business legislators, you know, give them tax breaks and deregulation and that kind of thing. So, and, you know, Mike Johnson's one of those guys. I wouldn't call him a you know, an intellectual or a serious-minded person. He's a politician. He's an opportunist. I know this may not be inappropriate, or maybe even appropriate. It may not be appropriate, but it feels weird for Republicans to claim Biden has cognitive decline considering Trump's statements on campaigns and interviews. He called Nikki Haley Nancy Pelosi. Yeah, they both over the hill. Now, you know, the reality is, you know, having, you know, little flubs and memory lapses really isn't that big an issue for being president as long as you've got enough there to, you know, consider the big issues, the big policy. You have a whole army of people that can keep track of the details and execute the policies. I mean, Reagan, you know, he was declining at the end of his term, but, you know, his government was unfortunately pretty efficient at what he wanted to do. But also, fortunately, like in the arms deals, you know, the arms control, nuclear arms control deals that they signed with Gorbachev in the Soviet Union. George W. Bush, I mean, he's one of those guys that couldn't find a country on a map. But, you know, he had a little army of people that, you know, was able to carry out the duties or carry out the administration. So I don't think it's that big an issue for either one of them. They're both getting up there in years, but I think they know enough to try to do what they want to do. Unfortunately, what they want to do is not what we want to do. BD Dimmitt, the tobacco industry should not have any level receiving business licensing for their making a disease, nicotine addiction that kills so many residents. But the question there is, if you criminalize, you know, tobacco, then you've got an underground industry. And we know what that happens with drugs. You know, it leads to a lot of violence. It leads to people who are addicted, not willing to seek help because they're involved in an illegal substance that could get them in trouble. So I'm not sure that's the best approach. I think we've done well by, you know, raising the prices and educating about the dangers of tobacco so that tobacco usage is way down. And in some countries, a lot down a lot more than the U.S. But, you know, I think that's a better approach than criminalizing drugs, you know, especially at the level of personal use. But if you don't have companies, you know, marketing tobacco products, then it's going to be, you know, mafias that are marketing tobacco products. And then you got a whole problem of criminal justice. And, you know, this is the last thing this country needs. We got more people in prison than per capita than any other country in the world and in absolute numbers. Okay, well, we're going to have Christina Khalil soon as a guest, and I need to get busy. I haven't had time to, you know, write some of these people that are willing to come on, but we'll start having guests soon. At this point, I guess next week we'll do, you know, a discussion of what's going on. This, we'll be able to talk about what happens to this foreign aid supplemental. There could be news on some of the Trump cases. And Gaza, you know, that's got to be a top concern. So we'll have plenty to talk about. So I hope everybody has a good week. Go 49ers. I have to say that I've been a 49er fan since I was a little kid. I used to take a milk carton called Christopher's Milk. It was the mayor's company in San Francisco. And you give them a carton and they'd pack us into this corner of the end zone, which was surrounded by fencing with barbed wire at the top, and we were packed in there like sardines, even if the stadium was half full. But I've been watching the 49ers since then, so it's an emotional thing. So I'm hoping they win the Super Bowl tomorrow. But whether you watch it or not, I hope you all have a good week, and see you next week.